Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. President Bush has told Americans to get on with their lives and let the U.S. armed forces fight the military part of the war on terrorism. So who will do the fighting, and are they ready? This hour, we'll look at the men and women on the front line in the war on terrorism. First, we check in with Andrew Koch, the Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly, for an update on military action in Afghanistan. Good evening, Mr. Koch.
Hello, good evening.
Thanks for joining us. The Pentagon didn't offer a full briefing today, we know, but what have we learned about the latest military moves?
Well, it appears that what is, in effect, Phase B or Phase 2 of the U.S. military strategy is wrapping up here. That phase is the phase where the U.S. does a significant amount of airstrikes, or at least a visible quantity of airstrikes against Taliban targets. I think that at this point they feel that they've run out of targets that they need to hit. They've significantly degraded the Taliban's military capabilities in terms of its equipment, and it's down to sort of the individual Taliban soldiers at this point.
There's some talk that we haven't gone in force after Taliban tanks. Have you heard that, and any thought on why not?
Well, they actually have done several strikes against Taliban tanks when they found concentrations of them. There was two strikes against Taliban forces up near the very key strategic city of Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan on both day one and day two, and they attacked a barracks there, which included both tanks and personnel from the Taliban and the al-Qaeda network.
And what's the larger strategy that appears to be unfolding here in the action so far?
So what the U.S. has done is tried to mitigate any risk, or to the degree possible, the risk that U.S. forces would face were they to go into Afghanistan, and that appears to be the next step. The introduction of actual U.S. troops into Afghanistan to hunt down the al-Qaeda terrorists where they stand. These troops are more than likely going to be small groups of specialized units, so-called U.S. special forces, that go in, and they'll be backed up by some specialized U.S. Army troops that will be on the standby. Were the small commando teams to get in trouble, a significantly larger force may be sent in via helicopter to come to their assistance.
We've also heard about the possibility of special forces going in via helicopter to do real damage to Taliban troop collections, gatherings. Any word on that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the U.S. strategies has been, it's been several pronged. One is to degrade the Taliban network, obviously to strike al-Qaeda where possible. The other one is to hit the Taliban from the air when possible. So what the U.S. Military officials are saying is that if the Taliban concentrates its troops in any location in the country, for example, to either attack the Northern Alliance or to repel attack from the Northern Alliance, if those concentrations provided targets that were such that they were amenable to be hitting from the air, that they would do so.
Mm-hmm. Any obvious surprises, good or bad, for the U.S. military so far in the Afghan campaign?
Well, so far, I think it's gone fairly well. But it's key to remember here that this campaign will probably not be short, and therefore, in many dimensions, the political and the psychological war that goes on around the world will be really key. The ability of the U.S. to keep the coalition together for an extended period of time, and the ability of the U.S. to, you know, in many ways, make sure that key governments that are supporting us don't come under such pressure that they have to change their stance.
And Andrew Koch, have you seen any apparent U.S. military contingency planning for instability in Pakistan, the nuclear power next door?
Well, the U.S. always has contingency plans for a variety of means. Clearly, the U.S. has thought through what needs to be done to make sure that Pakistan doesn't become unstable. I'm not sure there's a lot they can do to prevent things from happening on the ground there other than to mitigate the effects in terms of what their own operations are. And what I mean by that is they realize that they absolutely need to keep to a minimum U.S. involvement on Pakistani soil, for example. And they need to keep to a minimum U.S. attacks on any targets that could injure civilians, for example.
Andrew Koch is the Washington Bureau Chief for Jane's Defense Weekly. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
My pleasure.
Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, Navy, U.S. soldiers, sailors, and pilots will fight the military piece of the war on terrorism. National Guard and reservists are being called up to active duty. These troops are men and women, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, and all are volunteers. We're talking about the makeup, motivations, and preparedness of today's military. Who are the people fighting this war? What America does this volunteer army represent? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the NPR studio in Los Angeles is Laura Miller, a professor of military sociology at UCLA. Good evening, Professor Miller. Professor Miller, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we've got you now. Welcome, Laura Miller.
Terrific.
Also here in the WBUR studio is Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Riddler, U.S. Army Reserves. Good evening, Lieutenant Colonel Riddler.
Good evening, Tom.
And our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, is also here. Hello, Jack.
Good evening, Tom.
Laura Miller in California, paint us a picture of today's U.S. military. Who's going to be fighting this new war on terrorism?
Well, as you mentioned, this is an all-volunteer force, and so what we have today actually is more a middle cut of society. It's a small professional force. That means it's been able to be selective in the past decade or two about who it admits. So they're mostly high school graduates. They tend to come from the working and middle class. Our elites are less likely to join the U.S. military. They're more likely to come from the South. About 16% are women, and minorities, blacks in particular, are disproportionately represented.
And what percent African-American representation?
About 30%.
30%, so very strong. How does
yes.
this profile of the U.S. military compare with previous eras?
Well, in one way that it's different, and I don't know if people out there still have the stereotype of the military being a place to reform criminals or drug addicts or to, you
That's
know,
starting to
bring
seem starting to seem a long time ago, isn't it?
Yes. So today it's much more of a professional force, an educative force, a more technical force. They don't tolerate drug abuse or even alcohol abuse. They're stricter about requirements to get into the military in terms of discipline and affiliations with gangs, et cetera, before people join. So it's really the professional force. I think people got that impression during the Gulf War, that this is a different kind of force than they're used to seeing in television and movies.
And what has drawn most members of the U.S. military to active duty today?
Well, particularly with the good economy in recent years and people being able to get civilian jobs, we've had more of a focus.
Hello, Laura Miller. Are you there?
Can you still hear me?
Yes, we've got you again.
Okay.
Sorry, you said we had more of a focus on?
We have more of a focus on people joining for professional careers. We have a lot of...
We're having some technical difficulty with Laura Miller's line. Let me turn to Kevin Riddler, Lieutenant Colonel in the Reserves. A lot of Reserves are being called up as well. Is the profile of the Reservist similar to that of the active duty military that Laura Miller's just been describing?
A number of the jobs within the Reserves are similar to those on the active duty side. However, the makeup you see is typically very different. You get a cross-section of people. They might be policemen, lawyers, doctors, whatever, on their civilian side, bringing a number of those skills into play in their military portions.
So are they surprised to be called up? The last time was the Gulf War. What numbers of reservists have been called up at this point?
Right now we've had 27,000 across the board for all services called up. Mobilized is the term they use for that. Within the Army Reserve, with whom I work specifically, 3,100 have been called up. And then another 2,000 are being utilized in different jobs in support of the action right now.
And the National Guard would be yet another group?
That's correct. Well, part of that 27,000 will be National Guard. That's correct.
And so far, most of those have been deployed within the U.S. or what portion overseas?
Predominantly within the U.S. I won't say backfilling, but taking care of a number of the jobs that our active forces who immediately went over the things that they were doing. Although we've also had, just in the last week or so, a number of the units that we had forward stationed reserve units in Germany who have also been mobilized. So we know they're closer to the action.
Laura Miller, are you back with us?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we've got you. Great.
Terrific.
We're wondering, Laura Miller, what kind of concerns are on the minds of U.S. military men and women and their families in recent years? You've talked, we know from your research, with thousands of service people all over the world. What are the top concerns that have been foremost in their minds?
Well, some of the top issues have been dealing with the constant deployments to peacekeeping operations. And in some ways, people argued that this was perhaps working against their preparedness for war, that they were spending time doing tasks that weren't preparing them for combat, that they were getting tired, spending time away from families, working long hours, working in austere conditions. So those have been some of the top concerns.
And
also, we've had policy debates over the role of women in combat, gays and lesbians in the military. Those are sort of broader organizational issues. Individual soldiers, though, have been more concerned with deployment levels, care for their families,
and the peacekeeping role in particular. Will these issues be magnified or reduced by the new kind of war footing that the military is now on?
I think the issues will still be there, but the framework for understanding them will have changed. During the peacekeeping operations, there's been debate among the civilian leadership about, you know, to what extent should we be involved, how long should we be there, how many resources should we devote. And when the leadership's divided, we find that the public is also a bit more divided about whether we should devote, you know, resources and people's training and time away from families to such missions. But with something like this, where you have the government unified, and in fact, many nations around the world unified that this is an important, valuable mission, soldiers are not going to begrudge being away from their families or spending long times.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Ridler, looking back at this point and with the new challenge in front of us, does the peacekeeping mission that's been so prominent in the 90s look like it was a defocusing effort, or was it good practice for what we may be up against in Afghanistan and elsewhere now?
Tom, I believe not only good practice, but it allowed us to focus on perhaps the future mission of what we will need to be doing. And we're seeing that right now, where we have terrorists obviously taking action here within the United States and potentially at other places outside of the continental United States, either against our forces, against the embassies, et cetera. These are the kinds of things that we will need to concentrate on today and in the future.
What particular lessons from peacekeeping may be applied in this new kind of war, as President Bush calls it?
Well, if I could back up a moment with it, the peacekeeping at that point, there were complaints initially about we are not policemen per se. We are meant to go out there and protect the United States, and when the time comes, to fight directly. There is a time for fighting. There is a time also for keeping the peace literally. We need to know how to use the force we have, when to use restraint, and how appropriately, under the guidance of the civilian leadership, under the president, et cetera, the Secretary of Defense, to do the jobs that we're called upon to do. And this is most literally one of those jobs at this point we can't ignore any longer. We never did really ignore completely previously. We knew it was there, but we hadn't focused on it quite as much.
Mm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the U.S. military deployed in a new kind of war. Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Ridler, what's your sense of the morale in the U.S. military these days, at this moment?
Incredibly high. There's no doubt about that. We know we have a very focused mission. If you'd have asked me the same question 1 month ago today, the 10th of September, I wouldn't have been able to say quite the same. The morale was higher than it may have been 5 years ago, 4 years ago, et cetera. We know that there are some improvements that were taking place and some of the funding that we'd been told to expect, some of the buildup that, Laura, frankly, she referred directly to that. There was tremendous concern about quality of life for soldiers, for their families, the number of soldiers, especially the lower-ranking ones who may have been even on food stamps or the like to make ends meet. We're seeing that improve from that aspect. However, there is nothing that focuses your life and focuses your energies like having an incredible mission brought home like this one now for us.
Jack Beatty, will come back after a break, but here we see a military that's been in a time of peacekeeping, now in a new kind of war.
In a new kind of war and a new kind of soldier, a soldier with a family and a soldier with dependents and a soldier with the kind of responsibilities that the soldier in the past at home didn't used to have. And I'd be curious to find out what our experts think about the new sort of psychology of the fighting man with a family.
With a family at home. We're talking about the U.S. military thrown into a new kind of war. It's a hot war suddenly in Afghanistan, and we're told it may extend elsewhere. Do you have firsthand experience? Do you have loved ones in the U.S. military? Are you in the military yourself? Do you think we're ready for this war? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Photos of the FBI's most wanted terrorists are available on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. While fighting a war requires teamwork and troops, the U.S. Army is making a more personal pitch to would-be recruits.
I am an army of one. Even though there are 1,045,690 soldiers just like me, I am my own force. With technology, with training, with support, who I am has become better than who I was. And I'll be the first to tell you, the might of the U.S. Army doesn't lie in numbers. It lies in me. Corporal Richard Lovett. I am an army of one.
The latest U.S. Army recruiting line, the Army of One. We're talking this hour about the U.S. military going into a new kind of war with military sociologist Laura Miller, West Point graduate and lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves, Kevin Ridler, and special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty. Don't ask, don't tell, women in combat roles, low pay. In peacetime, these are hot-button issues. Now, as American-led airstrikes pound Afghanistan for the fourth night, do these issues have any importance? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Laura Miller, I want to ask you about the Army promotion we heard there just coming out of the break. The Army of One. Why was that crafted? What's the message there for the recruit or for the active-duty Army person?
Well, the message has been criticized by, I guess, most people over 30 who listen to it, saying it's promoting a sort of individualized idea that you're not working with a team, that you're not working collectively. But what they're really trying to tap into, and they've been very successful with young people, is the idea of people wanting a challenge, people wanting to improve themselves, people sort of getting away from the stereotypes as mindless robots who just follow orders. Mm-hmm. So they're really tapping into that desire. And one reason I think that I've found a lot of younger people are interested in the military is at the officer level wanting a real challenge or to really test themselves before they enter their professional careers, or often at the junior enlisted level, they want to do something more important with their lives than just selling goods. They want to feel like that what they're doing every day is somehow making a difference or helping improve the world. And that's what that's sort of tapping into.
Mm. Jack Beatty, Americans of a certain age remember the draft and Vietnam and a very different picture of the Army. Now we see a very professional Army, and still there have been these issues through the 90s. There have been debates at the top of the U.S. military about how it ought to be deployed and trained. Now we're into a new war.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that, what our guests think about that. There, throughout the 90s, conservatives, and most recently that Clausewitz of the airwaves, Dr. Laura, have asserted that the Army has lost its edge, that they're trying to deal with the social issues of the 90s, integrating women into the forces, the gay issue and so on, that this has weakened the Army and, as it were, feminized it. Now, I don't suppose there's any truth to that claim, but you hear that again and again, and you hear statements that, you know, the soldier's psychology, because he's thinking of his family now, is not the warrior psychology and so on. These are the sort of cliches one has heard throughout the decade. I wonder, Laura Miller, what do you say to that picture of the Army?
Well, one thing that's happened, one benefit that we've gotten from serving in these peacekeeping operations and from the Gulf War, is that a lot of notions that people had about what it would be like to have women in the field were dispelled. We've had casualties, and America was no more up in arms than having male casualties. Issues about women's hygiene and PMS and issues that were brought up often in the early 90s have pretty much fallen away to other issues. People have learned how to deal with privacy in the field for most of the occupations, and it's really helped advance the integration of women in the military. So basically what most of the arguments come down to now are physical strength issues, upper body strength issues in the combat arms. So we have greater integration of women now. And for all the operations that are going on now, women are involved in them. Women are more highly concentrated in intelligence and communications than a lot of other specialties. Women are allowed to fly combat aircraft. Women are serving on combat ships from which these missiles are being launched. Women are fully integrated in this mission, as far as they're represented in the military.
And to the strength of the military.
Well, again, because the women are in those particular fields because that's where they are qualified. Mm-hmm. And if you ask any commanders who've been out on these types of missions, they really value the skills that the women bring to them. There have been issues about managing male-female relations in a field deployment. And those are some of the things we've been working through over the past decade.
We are told again and again that this may be a very long deployment, or at least a long war. Relentless is another word that comes up. Kevin Ridler, you've pointed out that morale is high at the moment. Are there areas of vulnerability if this stretches out over a long time in many theaters and we see casualties, or do you see a good level of durability in the armed forces right now?
Within the armed forces, we've always known that there potentially are casualties. The greatest risk we run when that happens is the support back home, frankly. We saw that in Somalia, that people immediately want us to pull out of their other places like that. We went into the military. I went into the military personally knowing that someday I may have to put my life on the line for my country. I was willing to accept that. It's a known risk, but it's something that if we're going to defend our country, we have to be willing to be able to do. And the majority of people in the military do realize that. I know about 10 years ago when we were doing Desert Storm that there were a number of people who were called up in the reserves who wondered, what am I doing? I didn't sign up for this. And, well, what did you sign up for? I signed up for the education. Mm-hmm. And many of those people left after that. Those who remained were the true patriots who were in for the real reason, to serve. It's not an easy thing being what we call a citizen soldier, having to serve two masters. You have a full-time job and you have your military job on the top of that. Mm-hmm. These people who are now in there, they did it knowing what they were getting into, knowing what the possibilities were, and they've been rampant the last few years, the number of mobilizations we've had, et cetera.
We're at 1-800.
I'd like to make a point about
Laura Miller.
Casualties in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with that was that the first media coverage was of thousands of starving Somalis, and the message was, we're coming in to deliver humanitarian aid and rescue them. Then the Clinton presidency began, and we had debates about gays in the military. And so the attention was taken off of Somalia. And then the next thing Americans heard were that U.S. Rangers and Delta Forces and 10th Mountain Division infantrymen were killed. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing, bodies dragged through the street. So it wasn't that, America was prepared for a war or thought that a war or conflict was going on and that lives were lost. They were surprised. I thought we were there helping people. Why did this happen?
Right. There were mixed messages. At the moment, we don't really see mixed messages, but who knows how that will evolve over time. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We welcome your call. We're talking about the U.S. military, its profile and readiness as America heads into a new kind of war. Dave is on the line from Nashua, New Hampshire. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
I was in the Army about 1988 or so.
Okay.
17, and actually enlisted into the Ranger Battalion. And there were a number of others in the battalion and elsewhere in the military around my age. And throughout my experience, 6 years in the military, not a whole lot of people reenlisted in that time period. Certainly some did. There are bonuses and so forth. I was wondering what with some of the reductions in force and issues in the last 10 years, what is kind of the average experience age of our soldiers? Are they 17 or are they E5s after a couple of enlistments?
Good, Dave. We'll take that question. Laura Miller, what is the profile of experience in the military? How long have do people tend to have been there in different arms of the military today?
I don't remember the specific age, but the average age is, I think, mid-20s. We do have, at the beginning of the drawdown, a lot of people left the military because they thought of career instability. But
and when was that? When was that period, Laura Miller? When was that?
93.
Okay. Yeah, started 92.
It started earlier with the Army than the other mm-hmm. forces, mm-hmm. so it depends what force you're looking at mm-hmm. as to when the drawdown was undertaken. Mm-hmm. But and then another fear they had with the peacekeeping missions was that deploying people away from home was going to result in more and more people dropping out. Mm-hmm. That people entered just to get an education. They didn't really care about serving or participating in missions. But what they actually found was higher re-enlistment mm-hmm. rates for people who served in those overseas missions mm-hmm. and higher morale for those units that deployed frequently.
And Kevin Riddler, to Dave's question then, does that suggest that we have a more or less experienced military today than we have in previous eras?
I would suggest we have a slightly older, perhaps not more experienced in combat, as we've not had a tremendous amount of combat, thankfully, in the last number of years. However, we do have a more mature force than we had previously. Mm-hmm. And as Jack indicated, we have a force that when you're a father, when you're a mother, et cetera, it focuses you in ways that otherwise you perhaps would not be as a single person. Mm-hmm. And the predominant number of people in the military now are married, although we obviously have a number of single soldiers as well.
Yeah, the New York Times today had a piece quoting a wife of an officer at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, who said, "You don't have the luxury of falling apart."
Right.
Exactly. All this was happening to her. She had a moment's cry as her husband was sent abroad, but then she had to get ready for her daughter's party, and she had to buck up. Does the Army help the Army spouse, the person left behind, with the kind of strains they have, which is just extraordinary?
Incredibly, they do.
The military's made tremendous strides in the past decade in improving family support services and setting up email centers for families who don't have personal email to communicate with their soldiers, to have teleconferencing, to put into practice their networks and spousal support, and to reach out to spouses who might not be otherwise connected to the military community.
Laura, I think you hit exactly with that. I went to Haiti when our force went there in 94 and 95, and the job I was assigned, I was in charge of automation for the Joint Task Force, and then went out with a number of special forces, did different jobs throughout the island there. In Haiti, their portion of the island anyway. My first job was to set up that email connection back to the families. Mm-hmm. In fact, my wife, my bride, was living in St. Louis at the time with a family when I deployed, and I told her, go get an email account, and I'll get in touch with you right away. And so I had to do that.
There you have it. Job one, get the email connected back to loved ones in the U.S. It's the U.S. military we're talking about going into a new kind of war. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Do you feel our military is ready for this new, unusual kind of challenge? Are you in the military? What's your perspective from that vantage point? Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. This is Colonel Bill DelGrego. I'm an active duty Air Force officer that's up in the Boston area.
Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you. Thank you much. One, I think it's appropriate that you've got Ken there with you, a reserve officer, sitting in the studio with you, because one of the major points I wanted to make was that the U.S. military right now is a total force. And that little buzzword is important to know in 2001.
What does it mean, total force?
It means that we are combined active, reserve, and guard folks that do the single mission.
So is the reserve more important now that there's been a drawdown in the absolute number of military members?
I would say yes, and here's the reason. As you brought up in previous conversations about the reduction in force that took place at the very beginning of the Clinton administration after Desert Storm ended. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think we can categorize the military as we're about 35 to 40% less in personnel than we were during Desert Storm, which that's a fairly significant chunk of folks that have left.
Very large.
Of those folks that left, a lot of the things we did was to try to capture some of that technical expertise by hoping they would get in the reserves and the guard so that if we needed them again, all that training isn't lost. Mm-hmm. So I think what you'll find is if you look at the total force, the active duty, is a little bit younger, of course. For example, I just came from commanding a fighter squadron down in North Carolina, where I had 350 personnel and 24 F-15s, mm-hmm. and 230 of them were fairly young enlisted troops. Those were the guys that, you know, turned the wrenches and put gas in the jets,
yep,
et cetera.
Yep.
That's your young guy that we're getting. He's coming in with a good high school diploma. He's passed some tests to get in. He's fairly technically competent, very well trainable. I can tell you my discipline issues were low in what I thought I would have as a commander in a fighter squadron. You know, let's say in the real world, perhaps there's that 10% that aren't so good. So that would mean I'd have a problem child of 35 in my squadron. I had nowhere near that.
Bill, thanks for your observations from the front line. Kevin Riddler, how about that balance between active duty and reserves? Is it just as good to be drawing on the resources and talents of reserves when it comes to wartime, or is there some handicap involved in that?
There's a potential handicap that they may not have had all the day-to-day training that the actives have. However, we have found that because of the specialties they're involved in, and we alluded to that earlier, they may be a doctor assisting in medical cases, they may be policemen, they may be firemen back home, that they are training on their civilian jobs almost in a one-to-one direct correlation to the jobs we're asking them to do, and perhaps bring insight that our active forces may or may not have. So that's
actually
been a tremendous benefit.
I would second that. They've been quite an asset in a number of our overseas operations. In part, they've helped do the linkages between the U.S. military and other organizations, the relief organizations, the reporters, the local people, because a lot of people see them as sort of half military, half civilian, that they can sort of cross, you know, talk mm-hmm. cross-culturally, and they can see them as being in between the two. And so they've been quite an asset. And I think where we're going to be, you know, working with local populations and other organizations throughout, that they're going to prove to be not just as good, but in some ways quite an asset.
I spoke with Lieutenant General Tom Plewis, he's the Chief of the Army Reserve, and he mentioned one of the aspects that we have, both in the Guard and the Reserve, languages, for example. We've set up a number of Special Forces-type units out in Utah, where you probably perhaps know a number of the Mormon missionaries mm-hmm. have returned sure. to their home area, bringing 50, 60 different foreign languages in, and they've been able to form up units, and a number of these folks are more than willing to utilize the skills they had and bring just tremendous assets to the folks with whom they mobilize.
So the flags are all out along the streets. There's tremendous patriotism in the air, which, as you say, is always a supportive atmosphere for the military. And yet, this is a brand new kind of war. The threat is different than we've seen before. It can hit us domestically, we've seen. And our experience of the last 10, 15 years is that our military, as well-trained as it may be, is vulnerable in some of these unusual circumstances. We saw what happened in Mogadishu in Somalia. We saw what happened with the USS Cole off Yemen. Laura Miller, are you confident that we have the kind of military profile we need as we face this new kind of enemy, this sort of invisible, in the shadows, hit and run, asymmetrical opponent?
Well, I do know that we have been handicapped to some degree by diminished funding because some of the equipment has, you know, fallen back in quality, and there have been shortages in parts. But I do think we have learned lessons from the incidents in Mogadishu and the Cole, and that is to not get too cocky, to not be too casual because we see ourselves as technologically superior or perhaps educationally superior. So I think we've really taken those lessons to heart, and I hope, you know, that these lessons will actually be applied now in this type of operation.
Jack Beatty, do you feel that level of confidence? I mean, it is a new world out there, we're told.
It is. And, you know, the shock of combat always brings something new. I was just looking at the record today, and when soldiers were deployed in the first war, when they got thirsty, they scooped up water from the trenches and put mustard gas in their eyes. And in Korea, when they got thirsty, they dipped into the rice paddies, which, of course, had human waste in them and led to terrible dysentery. So it's going to be finding getting right with the bugs of Afghanistan is going to be a task.
And who knows just what those bugs
yes,
will be.
Yes, indeed.
We're talking about the U.S. military in a new kind of war. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the online conversation about the long-term solution to the political instability in Afghanistan. Log on to WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S. military in a new kind of war. America's fighting the first war of the 21st century. Are the troops ready? Are you comfortable having them do the dirty work while you, as President Bush has suggested, go to Disney World and get on with your daily life? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With us is military sociologist Laura Miller, Lieutenant Commander Kevin Riddler, and our special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty. We also have a lot of callers looking to join the conversation. Let's go to them right now. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening. My question and my thought is whether this particular conflict, because it involved an attack on the United States itself, might do something to end or at least bridge that cultural or class gap between the military and a lot of society that developed, particularly during the Vietnam War. I'm a veteran of 24 years combined active and reserve service. I just retired earlier this year.
Do you feel a better environment out there from a military perspective?
I see a lot of manifestations of patriotism or appreciation for not just military people, but also firemen and policemen that might have been also somewhat underappreciated for many years. But I really wonder whether, say, the more favored or more fortunate members of society are going to be a part of any military force, because it just hasn't seemed to have been the case over the last 30 years.
Right.
Or so.
Especially with the all-volunteer force, it again hasn't broken down that way. Jack Beatty, what's the pattern here, both of our U.S. reception of its own military and then of who's doing the sacrificing?
Yeah, that's one of the critiques of the sort of, well, you do Disneyland and they fight. I mean, the other model is the draft. The other model is that we're citizen soldiers, that there's no separation between the army and society, and that we don't leave the fighting to them. It's our fight, too. And I expect for people in the military, it often feels very lonely indeed to be, you know, out there on the firing line and the rest of us are going to Disneyland. It's very different if, you know, our Yale graduates and our Harvard graduates and everybody else is doing their military. There was something to be said for the draft as a democratic idea, but also as something that kept citizen and soldier together.
Laura Miller, how about that? Do you pick up in your interviews any sense of resentment in the U.S. military that they're doing the tough work when it comes time for the tough work while the rest of the country sits at home?
It's not so much a class consciousness among soldiers. What it is more, I guess, is sometimes a frustration that they are out protecting people's freedom to, you know, basically be anti-soldier, anti-military. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I mean, people have told me they're sitting in an airport and someone will come up and call them a baby killer. And I mean, this is, you know, the 1990s. So they feel bad that they're sort of a stereotype and that some people don't appreciate what they do. But certainly in a context like this, I think there's a greater sense of what they do and the risk they're taking. And also, I mean, this is protecting homeland, and a lot of people have problems with us interfering in affairs of other nations and trying to, you know, dismantle governments or covert operations.
There's a lot still to play out there.
This is protecting the homeland, and as you can see in the recent polls, America is going to be behind that.
There's a lot to come there. We have a lot of calls stacked up. Let's try and get another one in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is calling from Grants Pass, Oregon. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm retired military, and I think our forces will be okay, and they're going to do whatever it takes, but you have to find the objective first. I think this is the hardest part.
Yes.
So I want to make a point of finding all the objectives, meaning terrorists, and doing it and eliminating them or capturing them with the least amount of loss of innocent life that is possible. Mm. And I think George is doing a good job with that, the president, and I love him for that. But
we've got your point, Mike, and we thank you for your call. Kevin Riddler, what about this? Objective at the narrow level and the top level. At the top level, what's happened to the Powell Doctrine, where it would be overwhelming force on a very clear objective, but now we have a kind of open-ended objective? How will the military handle that over time?
It's obviously very, very difficult to try to locate exactly where they are, bring a mass force on a smaller force that's very widely dispersed. You can't do it in the same fashion that we fought for the wars, potentially the great red force that might come through the Fulda Gap. We don't have that kind of force to fight any longer. We do have to fight it on a much smaller scale, be it with special forces, be it with whomever. However, at the same time, attempting to bring the decisive force, decisive strength on our part to counteract the force that they bring. I want to get back to the point that Jack and Laura made earlier, and my kids have asked me when we're headed to Disney World as well, there's no doubt, but there has been a growing concern in the military and amongst the civilian side as well of the gap that had formed in many cases between them. Mm-hmm. General Creighton Abrams, shortly after Vietnam, made a statement, and the wisdom was incredible with it, that we will never go to war again without calling the reserves. We can't do that. And he was calling upon the lessons we learned from Vietnam, that by calling the reserves, by calling the National Guard, you bring in middle of wherever Iowa as part of the force as well, as opposed to if you send the 82nd Airborne, just the folks around that particular fort.
So you're saying it brings in a broader cross-section of the population?
It brings in the community because it's their father, their uncle, their sister who may be deployed as well, whereas as opposed to it may be Fayetteville, North Carolina, for the folks there.
Right.
Not just that, you're now bringing in everybody nationally.
Let's get one more call. Kimberly is on the line. Welcome, Kimberly. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I have a precious 21-year-old brother in the Air Force, and when he entered, my family was really upset about it because we're Quaker, and we're conscientious objectors and don't usually join the armed forces. I think he joined because he didn't feel that college was an option for him, and as much as I'm not always a supporter of the military, the experiences that he's had and the maturity he's gained and the skills and confidence that he's gained, I just can't believe it. I've been so impressed with the young man that he's grown into.
So it's been personality and career building in a way, Kimberly.
And maturity, responsibility, proving himself, earning the respect of others. It's been very positive. I don't know how well he's going to be prepared, though, for the realities of war. I'm concerned about him facing death and other people's losses. I think it's been great for him as a morale building and responsibility building experience, but I don't know how well he's prepared for that part of it.
We've got your point, Kimberly, and we'll be concerned for him too. Kevin Ridler, there you hear the son of a Quaker family in the military and his sister finding it's been a good education, but the education can get pretty tough sometimes.
Oh, it certainly can. I understand Kimberly's concern. Nobody is ever prepared for war until you've been there, and once you've been there, you don't want to go back. You wish you didn't have those particular experiences. This brings back, however, the recruiting aspect that we talked about earlier. The answer, the Marines were faced with the same response from their veterans saying, what are you doing with the Slay the Dragon commercial and all that? And the Army of One, what are you doing bringing that in? It's more the individual. And the answer that was given back by the leadership, we're not trying to recruit the 30 or over crowd. We're trying to recruit the under ones. And it resonates with them. And we're getting the message to them.
We're coming to the end of our conversation. Laura Miller, last thoughts on how well we're situated in the U.S. military to face this new kind of confrontation?
I think they're very well situated, particularly because I think the motivation is very strong, and in the country, the civilian level, the government level, and the military. And I think that's the most critical factor.
Jack Beatty, hard to imagine this conversation 20 years ago.
It is, but you could imagine this 20 years ago. This is from Tina Fortner, 33, whose husband Sean has just been sent abroad. She's in North Carolina. She says, we give them pre-addressed stamped envelopes. We tell them, we don't expect a novel, just, I'm alive, I love you.
And you can send it by email if the stamp doesn't
stick.
That's
right.
Laura Miller, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
And Kevin Ridler, thanks for being in the studio.
My pleasure.
And Jack, thanks to you as always. Laura Miller is a military sociologist at UCLA. She joined us from the NPR studio in Los Angeles. Kevin Ridler is a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Army Reserves and a fellow at the National Security Fellowship Program at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Jack Beatty is our special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. You can continue the conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Throughout this hour, we've been talking about who's serving in the U.S. military. Now, some of the youngest voices speak out. They are college students enrolled in ROTC programs. Historically, universities have been hotspots for peace activism. But as our special coverage correspondent Jonathan Saltzman reports, today there's a strong current of patriotism on campus.
Also, when you take your reading, make sure you keep your helmets flat so you get a proper reading. Any questions so far? What? I see you're also awake.
It's shortly after 7 in the morning. While many students at Northeastern University in Boston are still asleep, 75 young men and women in camouflage fatigues are sitting on the floor of the Cabot Gymnasium, hunched over maps as they learn how to read a compass. They belong to an Army ROTC unit made up of students from Northeastern and Boston College.
You need to make sure that you're aware of any metal objects or power lines nearby. They will affect your reading.
Like many of the 50,000 college students in ROTC programs across the country, some of the cadets in the Liberty Battalion at Northeastern joined the Reserve Officer Training Corps primarily to help pay for their education. The Army gives cadets scholarships worth as much as $17,000 a year toward the university's $24,000 tuition, plus a $250 monthly stipend. But then came the terrorist attacks on September 11th and America's counterattack in Afghanistan this week. The Bush administration says America's war on terrorism could last years. Pentagon officials have ruled out invading Afghanistan with ground troops for now. Still, some members of the Liberty Battalion are facing the harsh reality that their decision to join ROTC could one day mean having to go to war, if not in Afghanistan, somewhere else.
I think it's definitely a possibility.
Alex Engelson is a 19-year-old freshman in the battalion. He also belongs to the Army National Guard in his hometown of Framingham. He says that increases the possibility that he could be called to serve in the war, given that Guard units were deployed in the Persian Gulf War 10 years ago. But he isn't flinching.
That's what I joined for. I joined to serve the country. I know it's idealistic, but that was the main reason I joined. And whatever I can do, I'm willing to do it.
The Reserve Officer Training Corps program has been around for 85 years, but it's faded dramatically since the Vietnam War turned many young people off to military service. The number of students joining the Army ROTC last year, for example, was about 28,000, down from about 177,000 in 1967, the peak year. Representatives of ROTC programs with the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force say it's too soon to tell whether America's new war and flag waving across the country could rekindle interest in the program. But there are signs that it might. A spokeswoman for the Air Force ROTC, based at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama, notes that the weekend after the terrorist attacks, 150 college students applied for the program online, the most applications the website ever got in such a short period. But the members of the ROTC program at Northeastern say they decided to join months, if not years ago. Patrick McEgan, a 19-year-old freshman from Scranton, Pennsylvania, says military service runs in his blood.
I have one uncle that retired 25 years in the Navy. I have another uncle that teaches down at Willow Grove Air Force Base. I have an uncle that's 16 years of duty in the Marines. He's a gunnery sergeant down in Quantico. Both grandfathers served in the Navy in Korean Wars. And my dad was honorably discharged 12 years in the Army.
At some of the ROTC units on more than 400 college campuses, President Bush's call to arms has been incorporated into a curriculum that had been without a tangible enemy since the Gulf War. That's not the case at the Liberty Battalion, although cadets do discuss the war informally in classes, according to Captain John Pistone, who oversees recruitment for the program.
Something will happen in the news, and they'll ask, my opinion of what I think is happening. And obviously, I try to keep my comments to a minimum because all I know is what I'm reading in the newspaper, so I really can't give them too much insight, but I can tell them what I think, and I try to stress to them that they can do more for the Army right now by studying and learning how to be a leader and learning how to be an officer.
One thing you won't find when the Liberty Battalion gathers is anyone questioning President Bush's decision to wage war. Cadet Patrick McEgan.
The action taken right now, I think, is the best action that it can take. What the president is doing over there, he waited long enough, gathered all the right information, and is making his right decisions with his advisors over there. So everything he's doing over in Afghanistan, I think, is the right thing to do, and I support him 100% behind him because he's the president.
For WBUR's special coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
Your rifle, helmet, maybe some metal on your LCE.
Jonathan Saltzman is our special coverage correspondent.
You can log on to our website for photos of Afghanistan before and after the U.S. airstrikes and to learn about the history of Afghanistan and its neighbors online. Interactive maps and more are available. You can also continue conversations that we've started here on Special Coverage. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.